This Morning, America's First News starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The new landscape for shoppers. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka, on this Friday, November 26. Glad you could be with us, and here's what's up this hour.
With Black Friday in mind today, holiday shopping has changed significantly since the start of the pandemic. We'll examine the four big ways.
Police departments are getting their money back a year after the movement called Defund the Police. We'll have examples.
A list of five things you should not buy on Black Friday, like furniture.
And how many emails is too many to store?
There's a lot contained within our emails, and I don't want to throw them out. So people have different reasons, but, you know, let's just say we have a lot of emails. The average inbox has, according to one study, about 8,000 emails.
Charles Passy, email hoarder at MarketWatch, on why we save so many. Well, this holiday season is going to look a lot different for the retail industry and for consumers. For example, businesses are prepared to greet more customers at the store. It's a story by Melissa Repko, retail reporter at CNBC. Melissa, what's trending?
Yes. So one of the big trends is that while people are still shopping online, they're going back to stores too. And there's a couple of different reasons why that's happening. But one of the dynamics is that people miss some of the traditions they used to have. So going to the store with family members, sometimes on Black Friday or just in the weeks leading up to Christmas. And then also with supply chain concerns, some people are just really nervous. They'd rather have an item in their hand rather than waiting for a box to arrive on their doorstep. And in a store, perhaps you can find something else. If you can't find exactly the toy that your child wants, then you can find something close to it. And that's something that may be a little bit more difficult online. So that balance between the two, stores versus online, has changed. And the other dynamic is people are going back to some experiential gifting. So last year, you know, people couldn't go to the spa, they couldn't go out to dinner, they couldn't book a beach getaway. And this year, that's expected to gain steam again because there's a pent-up demand to get out and about, and gifts will reflect that. Even things like gift cards are more meaningful when people feel like they can actually use them.
Wow. So it seemed like maybe two of your points were somewhat connected. You pointed out that there's the potential here for slowing e-commerce growth, but at the same time, this return to stores. So by going to stores and physically purchasing something, you know, the way we used to, that's going to take away perhaps from the growth of e-commerce sales, if I understand
that? Yes. Exactly. E-commerce sales are still high, but the growth rate is not as dramatic as a year ago. But people have also incorporated some aspects of online shopping into their routine and are kind of doing a blend of the two. I think a lot of people did curbside pickup for the first time, and that's going to stay popular this holiday season. A lot of retailers are prepared for that. So, you know, swinging by, particularly during the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, being able to pick up those toys without walking into the store, standing in line, is a nice solution for people. So that's somewhere in the middle. It's an online sale, but it still is you interacting with the store in some way.
We're speaking with Melissa Repko, retail reporter at CNBC. Her story is called Four Ways Holiday Shopping Has Changed Since the Pandemic Began. One of the other points, too, you referenced buy now, pay later, like the old layaway thing. That's back?
Yes. You know, this is a kind of a more tech-savvy version of layaway. So the way that layaway worked, and Walmart was especially known for it, is that people would pay off that gift, think like a Barbie car or another kind of toy, and once they had paid that off, they took it home with them. But in the meantime, that Walmart store kept that item on hand and kind of saved it for them or reserved it for them. With Buy Now, Pay Later, companies from Walmart to Macy's are actually working with these companies that take care of all of that. So instead, the person who buys the toy gets it right away, whether that's at the store or shipped to their home, and then they pay it in installments. And it kind of takes some of the work away from retailers, which is why retailers find it a little bit more appealing, and it takes away the risk as well. So they're not having to keep that item on hand. And you can imagine in a year where inventory is already a challenge, that's yet another reason why they might want to direct shoppers to this alternate option.
Yeah. These experiential gifts, too, the kind of the memory-making things. I know that's been trendy. In fact, a friend of mine was just saying she is buying for her daughter like a gift card to maybe a bed and breakfast. And then for her other son, it's going to be movie tickets to some amphitheater in Colorado. But are those more expensive necessarily than a traditional gift?
That's a good question. Not necessarily. It could go either way, because it could be anything from, you know, buying someone movie tickets, which would be on the lower price range, getting them Broadway tickets, which could be on the higher end. But I also think experiential gifting may get a bounce, not only from kind of the pent-up demand factor, but people also saying, hey, I'm a little nervous about finding the right gift and having some trouble with out of stock. So instead, I'll get a gift card, or instead I'll say, hey, I'll take you on a trip or do something special with you for a day or take you to a fancy restaurant, because then you don't even have to worry about an item being in or out of stock.
Yeah. Thanks, Melissa. Melissa Repko, retail reporter at CNBC. Coming up next, how to avoid being triggered so easily. Dell Technologies' biggest business sale of the year has arrived. Step up your vision with top tech up to 50% off during their Black Friday event. Dell Technologies recommends Windows 11 Pro for business, plus get incredible savings on Windows 11 PCs along with servers, monitors, and docks, all with free shipping. There's also special financing with Dell Business Credit. Get started by contacting your Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for being with us on this Black Friday. Why are we seemingly triggered so easily these days, letting others impact how we feel? Is it possible to live trigger-free? Here's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
So why are we all losing our minds so easily these days? Whether it's that other driver that cuts us off or a nasty comment on social media, many of us are triggered like never before. Here with some in-depth analysis is Shasheen Shah, executive coach and author of The Kid and the King, The Hidden Inner Struggle High Achievers Must Conquer to Reignite and Reengage with Life. Shasheen, what does it mean to get triggered?
Good morning. What does it mean to get triggered? I would just argue, I guess any time you have a negative reaction to something, something that bugs you, something that upsets you, and, you know, I kind of started looking at the roadmap of the world and, you know, the good life, and I figured, you know, the person that's getting the least triggered at the end of the day is really winning the game of life.
Why does this seem to be happening more?
Is it? I don't know. Is it happening more? Maybe we're just more aware of it. I mean, I think it's been troubled times. I mean, COVID certainly has put some, you know, some of us in the pressure zone. And I mean, if you had that little crack on your windshield on the passenger side and you've been ignoring it, these times certainly have like shattered the windshield for a lot of people. So I think a lot of people are a little bit more sensitive and a little bit more aware and maybe less distracted. So we're kind of feeling it a little bit more. But I've been seeing it. I guess you're right. I mean, I think I've been seeing that in my clients and just overall in society for sure.
It does seem that one bad thing seems to bother people more than maybe 100 good things that happen in a day. Why do we focus on the negative?
Because we're wired that way, man. We are so wired for survival. We're so wired for the threat. And I think that's one of the most important things in the world to recognize about the human condition. I mean, if we really understand the hardware and the software that we've been equipped with as human beings, we can immediately discover without any degrees that we are wired for survival. So our instincts automatically will go to a threat, what's wrong, what's difficult, what's challenging, and what's upsetting, because we're trying to survive. And it sounds so simple, but if you start to look through life through that lens, you'll start to see and start to understand how predictive it is and how automatic and how simple we are as human beings, and how the same things upset us and we act like we're surprised every time it happens.
We're speaking with Shasheen Shah, executive coach. How do you go about trying to control your negative emotions?
I wish there was an answer to that. The answer is going to be a little bit shocking. You can't control your negative emotions, honestly. They're a part of the experience. Without darkness, there is no light. There's the yin and the yang. We've been told a million times that there is contrast in life. Without the contrast, life becomes boring. Now, that being said, The way I like to break it down is really simple. You want to ID the emotional state that you're in, right? So if you're having a bad moment, if you're driving in your car now, if you're listening to the show, and all of a sudden your husband, your wife, your kids, whatever they may have, and if you're not feeling great, you ID the emotion and you ask yourself, what is the intensity with which I want to experience this? And what is the duration with which I want to experience this? So the only levers I think that you can pull when you go into that place is how intensely do you want to experience it and for how long? That is where the artistry, I think, comes in with negative emotions.
So how do you actually do that? What do you tell yourself?
My gosh, you know, here's the thing. It's like we act as if like these triggers are some surprise, right? Because we go through life with an expectation. It's funny, once you start to change your relationship and start looking at, but one of my mentors said to me, he's like, Shashin, you're not that interesting, actually. It's like the same thing every day. These kind of, this tonality, these kinds of people, these comments, these, right? They're all the same every single time. And he said, it's like, for a sports analogy, right? It's like being a baseball player, right? And watching a pitch go high and outside and swinging at it recklessly. I mean, when you start to really break yourself down and really do some work on yourself and understand, it's not even that much work. You understand the patterns with which that they come at you and you start to like understand what those look like. You start to see it coming high and outside. You don't swing at those pitches. You don't take the bait. You don't get triggered by it. You just look at it and be like, that was interesting. Oh yeah, I know that one. Oh yeah. There he goes again. The guy who just cut me off. I know what that is. And I know my reaction. It's pretty predictive. I know that if I go there, then I elevate my heart rate. And I know elevating my heart rate is never going to do any me. It's not going to do me or the other person any good. It's not going to make me live a better life. So as soon as you decide you want to become responsible for your emotional reaction, that's when things start to change.
That's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka with Shashin Shah, founder of Coherent Strategies Consulting and Coaching and author of the book The Kid and the King. Coming up next, how Cheesecake Factory survived the pandemic. Holiday parties are back, making it the perfect time to do a reset and upgrade your look. The Black Friday event from Indochino offers their lowest prices of the year on suits, shirts, outerwear, and more. Even lower if you use the code Gordon at Indochino.com. You can go to a showroom or measure yourself online at Indochino.com. That's what I did. The chinos I customized are the best fitting pair of pants I've ever worn, a feeling you cannot get with pants off the rack. Indochino suits start at just $299. Shirts start at $45 with all customizations included. Get away from your video call style and back into looking and feeling amazing. Indochino's Black Friday event runs from November 8th to the 29th. Save even more and get $50 off any purchase of $399 or more by using promo code Gordon at Indochino.com. That's $50 off a purchase of $399 or more at Indochino.com. Indochino.com, promo code Gordon. Again, Indochino.com, promo code Gordon. Hey, glad you're with us. With its massive menu offering everything from crispy chicken sandwiches to coconut cream pie cakes, Cheesecake Factory already ran among the most complicated operations in the restaurant industry. It's emerging from the pandemic with a model that's even more sprawling and complex. It's a story of survival from Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon. Heather, take us through it.
Yeah, well, Cheesecake Factory actually does exemplify what some of the big casual dining chains have done and done successfully so far, which is really push delivery, online orders, and pickup for their restaurants during the pandemic when they had to close their dining rooms. And these chains now have been surprised that a lot of this ordering is still sticking around. A lot of people are still ordering delivery or online or pickup, even as their dining rooms have reopened. And it's been a bit of a surprise and something to now that they're changing their business model for to keep expecting that it will continue.
Wow. All right. Changing the business model. How?
Well, it does require staff to do all this. So first of all, you have to have the back-end technology to do it, an online ordering system, a delivery partner. Often there's like dedicated pickup spots to facilitate these orders. Some chains are now even thinking about installing pickup windows in their restaurants because they believe that's that's how much of this business is going to stick around. So actually making infrastructure changes to make it so easy to just pick this stuff, pick this cheesecake or food up and go.
Wow.
So they are starting to think really long term about this.
And as you point out in the story, cheesecakes travel well, right?
Yeah, so that was something that was definitely an advantage for the Cheesecake Factory, that its bakeries are vertically integrated into its business, which means they get higher margins on this cheesecake. They make it all in-house in dedicated factories. And like anyone who's, you know, gotten some dessert or cheesecake at a restaurant and take it in home to eat later, you know that it does travel well, as opposed to maybe French fries or some other hot food that can get degraded as you take it from the restaurant. The cheesecake is cold, it's firm, it's packaged well, and it does travel well.
Wow. We're speaking with Heather Haddon, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her story is called How Cheesecake to Go Saved the Cheesecake Factory. Explain how they kind of managed operations for delivery during the pandemic, how they changed things around.
Yeah, so this can really slam a kitchen when you have this much delivery coming at potentially a peak time when you also have your restaurant dining room is full of diners. So they're trying to work with their delivery partner, DoorDash, to make sure that those orders come in and are spread out and their kitchens can handle it as they also try to serve folks inside. But then they've also just really marketed it. You know, they've let people know on social media and other advertising that this exists. They've run a lot of promotions, you know, get a free slice of cheesecake or something else when you order some other kind of food for lunch or at some other time of the day, because they really want people to know about this and to keep using it.
And Cheesecake Factory is actually expanding its menu, right? Or did at a time when many restaurants were not, or slimming them back.
Yeah, so they did not cut their menus. They actually kept their annual cheesecake new flavor promotion, where in the summer they add a new flavor to their already long list of flavors. They brought back some fan favorites to try to keep people coming, because their philosophy is, you know, they're all about choice. So if that's going to be part of their brand, then they needed to keep that up, even if it was challenging to do.
Thanks, Heather. Heather Haddon, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. This is pretty sobering. Every 10 seconds, someone becomes a victim of fraud or ID theft. And even worse, 23% never recover their money. If you think it can happen to you, that's what they're counting on. But now there's Aura. Aura is all-in-one protection from identity theft, financial fraud, malware, scam sites, and more. And Aura alerts you to fraud and threats fast, like if your online accounts or passwords were leaked or if someone tries to open a bank account in your name. It's a new type of security service that protects all of your online information with one simple subscription. Aura is easy to set up, and all plans come with $1 million in identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experienced U.S.-based customer support that's got your back. Right now, Aura is offering our listeners early access and 3 free months when you visit aura.com/Gordon. Go to aura.com/Gordon to get access before anyone else and 3 months for free. That's aura.com/Gordon. Thanks for being with us. Friday, November 26, Black Friday, Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, police departments get their money back a year after the defund movement. Also, apps making trading stocks feel like a game. Plus, email hoarders and things not to buy on Black Friday. We'll have that list in about 20 minutes. Well, in cities across America, police departments are getting their money back following last year's push to defund them. From New York to Los Angeles, departments that saw their funding targeted amid nationwide protests over the killing of George Floyd have watched as local leaders voted for increases in police spending. J. David Goodman, Houston bureau chief at the New York Times, says the abrupt reversals have come in response to rising levels of crime in major cities, the exodus of officers from departments large and small, and political pressures. David, what did you find?
When I started looking at the Dallas situation, so I've been covering police departments in New York City and elsewhere for a little while now, and also sort of the politics around policing. And I found it interesting that the Dallas mayor had come out over the, I guess it was in the fall or maybe late summer, and said, you know, in a Medium post that he that Dallas needed more police. And this is the kind of thing that if you said it last year, you know, at the height of the protests and around policing and calls for police reform, you know, would have caused a firestorm. And yet he didn't really have any kind of reaction. The people didn't see that as controversial. And so that seemed to me a moment in the politics of policing and in the situation in Dallas in particular that needed to be looked at more. And so that's what I did. And I, you know, sort of came away with the story that this is not just a, something that's happening in one city, but really across the country, the temperature around policing has come down a lot. And while there's still efforts to reform, you know, what police officers do, there's not the same kind of noise around taking away the money. And in fact, most cities, at least the ones that we looked at, have actually significantly increased funding or returned it to where it was prior to the protests last year.
Wow. All right. Where is that happening where they not only, I guess, got their money back, but maybe then some?
Well, I thought there's a couple interesting examples. I mean, in Los Angeles and New York, both have increased police funding. In Austin, Texas, they did it, although that was partially in response to the Texas legislature and the governor more or less making it, barring them from defunding. They actually would have taken away state money had the Austin city kept with its funding level for its police department. So there's a lot of political pressure involved here, too. It's not just that cities are acting on their own, but you know, then you go look into a place like Burlington, Vermont, which is a quite a liberal city. It's where, you know, Bernie Sanders used to be mayor, and they had taken steps to, you know, rein in police spending last year. And they found that they were actually, not because of this, but because of a lot of other reasons, losing a lot of officers. And so they, in order to retain the officers that they had and get new ones, were approved a budget that had $10,000 bonuses for the police officers that were currently on the force.
Wow.
So there's just a real sort of change and almost like a return to, you know, a time prior to some of these protests when it comes to the way, you know, budgets are treating police departments.
We're speaking with J. David Goodman, Houston bureau chief at the New York Times. His story is called "A Year After Defund, Police Departments Get Their Money Back." At the time, and I'm not asking this in a, some smart aleck way, like what did folks expect was going to happen, or what did they hope was going to happen?
Well, I think the you know, there's been a lot of caricaturing of the positions that people had in the sort of police reform movement. And I think the phrase defund the police is something that a lot of folks who want changes to policing really came to regret and don't like, you know, being tagged with. Really what the what they were calling for last year, and I think is still part of the reform movement, is, you know, a redirecting of resources away from purely treating crime as a police problem and treating it more of a as more of a social problem, to look at some of the, you know, the underlying factors that really are present in almost every neighborhood where you have high crime. And rather than putting that money in at the tail end when the crime is happening to, you know, make arrests, try and think about how you could put that money in at the front end to sort of prevent the crimes from taking place and improve the neighborhood so people aren't turning to crime. And the other thing that's happening, and this is happening in Dallas as well, is that they're putting more money into alternatives to policing. So you see, you know, teams that are meant to respond to mental health, people that are having mental health episodes that include more EMS and more people that are used to dealing with folks in that kind of distress, rather than just sending the police. Because you have a lot of these, you know, deadly police encounters happen with someone who could be dealt with in a less confrontational manner if, you know, you had the person with the proper training. At least that's the idea and what some cities are trying out.
Thanks, David. J. David Goodman, Houston bureau chief at the New York Times. Coming up next, when trading stocks feels like a game. Dell Technologies' biggest business sale of the year has arrived. Step up your vision with top tech up to 50% off during their Black Friday event. Dell Technologies recommends Windows 11 Pro for business, plus get incredible savings on Windows 11 PCs along with servers, monitors, and docks, all with free shipping. There's also special financing with Dell Business Credit. Get started by contacting your Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for spending part of your Black Friday with us. Not long ago, Robinhood would reward users of its investing app who made their first trade by dropping confetti. That experience, critics say, is an example of how investing apps have attempted to turn elements of stock trading into a game, a technique called gamification. Is that risky? insight from Brett Molina, consumer tech reporter at USA Today. Brett, what is gamification?
So essentially what it is it takes elements of video games and it applies them to different activities. This is this kind of concept has been around for a while now. This isn't just exclusive to a lot of the investing apps that we're seeing in a lot of these practices. We see it across a lot of different platforms. Anything from even like Facebook, where it's like you do things like posts and stuff like that. But it's essentially what it is it turns activities within apps and makes them feel more like a game to keep you engaged. A really good example is on Robinhood, because one of the earliest things they did on their app was when you would make your first trade, there would be confetti that dropped. And so that was kind of an opportunity for users to get excited and to also just feel more engaged within the app. And then in turn, they would use the app more often.
Okay. So there appear to be obvious traps here, but explain what might be wrong with that.
So with the experts I talked to, they seem to support the concept of gamification overall in terms of, you know, you're learning more about investing, you're learning more about the market. Where it can become a problem, though, is when it goes from investing as a rational practice to becoming more emotional, because you're looking at it too much like a game and not something that has actual real-world financial impact. And that's where it gets a lot of people in trouble. And the important thing to know is, while these tools are fun and it helps make investing fun and easy to learn, you can fall into that trap of treating it too much like a game, and then that's where you get into trouble.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds great in practice, but how do you draw the line between rational and emotional? How do you know? Maybe you are terrific at picking stocks. You really do thorough research.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if, you know, I think it's one of those situations where if you find yourself more invested in the app because of, you know, those different little rewards or things that they use to pull you in, then that may be a moment to take a step back and think about, well, why are you doing this? You know, it's important to have kind of goals in mind when you're investing. And I think as long as the actions that you take within these apps align with those goals that you have set, and you're not making decisions that are going off that because of just, you know, you're hoping to get a reward within the app, then that's where you need to kind of figure out, maybe I need to step back and rethink what I'm doing.
We're speaking with Brett Molina, consumer tech reporter at USA Today. He's written a piece entitled, Apps Make Trading Stocks Feel Like a Game, But That May Not Be a Winning Investment Strategy. How about the impact on the brain here? I thought this was a good deeper dive.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the biggest things that gamification does is it taps into chemicals in the brain that allow us to experience pleasure. I mean, it's that dopamine hit that we always get, and it's what makes us excited. And whether it's playing video games or watching a show or anything we do, that's just kind of gets us excited about experiences. And, you know, one expert I talked to mentioned how, you know, our brains love uncertainty, and all those rewards that might be hiding behind, you know, whatever door, wherever it is, whether it's, you know, you invest in a stock and all of a sudden the price goes up. Our brains kind of love that uncertainty, and that's what we're chasing with some of these apps sometimes.
Yeah. So what could the Securities and Exchange Commission do?
Well, they are exploring apps like Robinhood that use some of these techniques. One of the concerns that has come up is, you know, encouraging investors to trade more and change their investment strategy. This gets back to what I was saying earlier, where if you have certain goals in mind with how you're investing, are these apps applying techniques where you're suddenly finding yourself changing that strategy because of certain rewards that the apps might be offering? And so that's where the SEC wants to get a closer look and figure out, you know, what exactly are these apps doing, and are they, you know, applying techniques that would make investors change their strategy in ways that could negatively harm them?
Thanks, Brett. Brett Molina, consumer tech reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, what makes you an email hoarder? Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy. Thanks for joining us. Well, with a flurry of messages from friends and colleagues, plus an ever-flowing stream of solicitations, newsletters, and more, many of us are contending with email overload. How many emails are the right amount in your inbox? Charles Passy, admitted email hoarder at MarketWatch, has some insight. Charles, set the scene.
Well, people just, you know, it's a kind of almost like a form of hoarding. People just can't let things go. And they say, look, I like my emails because someone likened it to having mementos in a curio cabinet. So I guess that's kind of a silly way of putting it. But other people have said, look, I like to search my old emails in case something comes up. You know, as one person said, you know, it's one thing to have the email contacts, but having the actual emails gives me the context. So if I want to look up a previous conversation I had over email, or you know, details on a deal I was trying to do or something like that, that you know, there's a lot contained within our emails and I don't want to throw them out. So people have different reasons, but you know, let's just say we have a lot of emails. The average inbox has, according to one study, about 8,000 emails, but I found, you know, people with many more than that.
My goodness. All right, you're among them. You have almost a quarter million.
I'm guilty as charged. I have about 250,000 emails. And you know, I would add to that, I mean, in addition to the fact that I do like to look at old emails for details of various kinds and all that, I would also say that, you know, I find it just very hard to go through all my emails. I get about 500 work-related emails a day. I find it very challenging to go through all of those efficiently. And then what happens is what was started as a little task, you know, I'll say, well, let me catch up a month at a time, becomes a gargantuan task. There's no way I'm going to go through 250,000 emails. So I mean, at best, I can try to keep up with it on a daily, weekly, maybe monthly basis going forward, but there's no way I can undo the past. And as I said, there may be a lot there that I still want to hold on to.
We're speaking with Charles Passy, reporter at MarketWatch. He's written about workplace email overload. Somebody said in the story, too, if you have that many emails, you're not making decisions.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is a good point to be made about how does this affect your work life. And, you know, I talked to a few different people, business coaches, who really took a hard line against this. You know, one said, look, it's really just a form of clutter in your life. If you were talking about physical mail, would you keep, you know, 250,000 pieces of actual mail sitting on your desk? Think about that. That would be an avalanche of, you know, snail mail on your desk. It would be impossible. And it would clutter up your life. Well, they said, think about it the same way. What happens is that you tend to, that when you have that much email going on, you're just, it shows you're not responding to things. So what they said is, you know, basically this one particular coach's philosophy was delete or deal with it. And so she gave me the three deals, three D's: deal with it, or delete, or delay, but delay with a very set time frame. Like, I will respond to all my emails by the end of the week or by the end of the day. And this particular person said, really, if you're running at top efficiency, you should have no more than 100 emails in your inbox.
Thanks, Charles. Charles Passy, reporter at MarketWatch. Well, supply chain issues and high inflation are complicating Black Friday deals this year. MarketWatch has five products you should skip buying during Black Friday sales events. Number one, clothing. Based on the Black Friday deals being offered already, apparel discounts were comparable to what we've seen in past years, but it's possible that the starting dollar amount may have slightly gone up. Number two, PS5s and Xbox Series X's. The so-called deal is simply being able to access one at retail price, since supplies are low. Number three, exercise equipment. Wait until we're closer to the new year, experts say, when brands lean in on resolutions to get in shape. Fourth item not to buy on Black Friday, TVs. Usually, the TV models that go on sale on Black Friday are outdated models. But around the Super Bowl, you'll have a better shot at getting a newer, higher quality model. And number five, furniture. You'll have another opportunity to score huge furniture savings on President's Day in February. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.